watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, we continue in Chapter 7 of The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. In it, he envisions how the social practices that are now oppressive and destructive could be transformed following the collapse of industrial civilization. The question is, will any humans be able to survive the ecological destruction created by pollution and overconsumption? I've been soliciting commentary from listeners on the material I've been presenting. And this week, I have a very special commentary to share with you, an audio piece produced by Alex Smith, the host of my favorite environmental show, Radio EcoShock, out of Vancouver, BC. So we'll begin with Alex's commentary.
And we're a home going to die. Yes, we're a home going to die.
Pick a date, any date. The race is on to nail down the big crisis, the day the oceans die and humans go extinct. John Doscher is just one example of this latest blood sport, but he's in the very best company. Doscher is an 82-year-old self-taught man who laid out his doom and gloom on August 9th at the 2009 New York Green Fest. That speech was broadcast across the country by the underground hit show Unwelcome Guest. Apparently, host Lynn Gary took some flack for Doscher's untrained claims, and especially for the old man's prediction that humans should go extinct in the year 2034. Or was it 2033? It makes a big difference. Guys like this give honest doomers like myself a bad name. I'm Alex Smith, host of another depressing syndicated program, Radio EcoShock. First of all, who is John Doscher? The man doesn't even have a web page, for heaven's sake. No email, doesn't show up on Google. Can he be real at all? Once I get over my frustration at not being able to effortlessly peg this guy as a would-be prophet, I build myself up in froth of righteous green anger. Men like this give environmentalism a bad name, I think. What's an amateur doing, trying to sum up the world with far-out solutions like ending all commercial fishing? Or going all the way out there, like banning new babies around the world for 20 years to prevent that overpopulation thing? Then I recall my own amateur status. Aren't we all doing the same thing? Aren't we all trying, like a million computers, to figure out the big picture, to solve our suicidal urges as a species? I've seen photos of a building in Japan the size of 10 football fields. It's entirely filled with supercomputers, all calculating our climate future. But in the end, there's no group consciousness to interpret the results. We can work in teams, and scientists do. But finally, the conclusions form in just one mind at a time, yours and mine. Some people may be brighter than others, but there is no guarantee that the most honored scientist in the world will get it better than an 82-year-old in upstate New York. We don't know where or when some unannounced mind will crack the code, will discover another valuable grain of truth. So we all try, and we should.
Can't you hear the clock is ticking? We're slipping away, away.
I'm not going to analyze John Doscher's whole speech. Get it yourself at Unwelcome Guest, Program 476, Hour 1, at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, dot net, Unwelcome Guest, 476, Hour 1. Doscher made me mad, then he made me think, and I thought about it for days, and that's the sign of good radio. When I looked around, there were a collection of top experts and government advisors saying some of the same things about our limited time left on this planet, at least as we've known it. A few claims made in Doscher's speech run against every scientific opinion I've ever heard so far, like this one, claiming that Great Britain would become a desert.
Another prediction is that at today's rate of emission of carbon dioxide from its territory, Great Britain will be a desert within a century.
In fact, James Lovelock and the Tyndall Center and most predict that the UK will remain a relative refuge of green life because it is surrounded by cooling ocean currents. Same thing for Japan. So I'm tossing that claim in the can. Instead, I want to focus on just two main things that Doscher said that seem outrageous. For one thing, he says overfishing leaves uneaten algae that bloom into dead zones that emit hydrogen sulfide gas that will kill off the plant and animal world. Crazy. Or is it? We'll investigate the oceans will kill us theory with Dr. Peter Ward, Dr. Daniel Pauly, and Dr. Boris Worm. But okay, let's hear a bit from that John Doscher speech at the New York Green Fest.
Here's an example. In 2008, about April 23rd on WSKG-TV, there was a National Geographic special, Strange Doings on Planet Earth. European fishing fleets had destroyed the fishery off Southwest Africa. They left. The fish began to return, but too slowly. The plankton, which normally, most of them by far, have their life cycles on or near the surface, weren't eaten. They died, sank to the bottom in unaccustomed tonnages, and rotted, producing huge amounts of hydrogen sulfide and methane. These were locked into the ooze by pressure. But when a low-pressure weather system went overhead, they were released in New Jersey-sized explosions. The hydrogen sulfide killed all the fish. The methane went into the atmosphere, where it stays for about a decade. Methane, molecule for molecule, is 103 times as powerful a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. I have to change tenses now because that process is still going on. Indeed, there seems to be no way to stop it. Then, a few weeks later, there was a news item on NPR that there are presently 200 such zones around the world, and I wish that somebody would check that out. Can we live with extinctions? With mass extinction? Can we live on a planet whose temperature has been raised 25 degrees by huge releases of methane? No, we cannot. Such a release occurred 55 million years ago. It raised the Earth's temperature 25 degrees, extinguishing at least 95% of all species. Had there been humans, they would have been extinguished very quickly. Taking care of the ecology matters. If we don't figure out a way to stop that methane release process off Southwest Africa and all those other places, very soon, we're gone. Well, couldn't we wait it out in underground cities? The answer is that it took the Earth 10 million years to evolve a new biosphere that worked. Could those facilities last 10 million years?
Probably you heard a few alarm bells going off. First of all, did the Earth's climate go up 25 degrees 55 million years ago? Well, he's talking Fahrenheit, of course. Most scientists use Celsius, which would be a lot lower. Still, I'd have to do a lot of checking before I'd believe that figure. Now we consider that a rise of 6 degrees Celsius, mean global temperature, should be enough to kill off most life on Earth, except at the poles and deep under the sea. But there's a lot of assumptions in Doscher's claims that scientists wouldn't make. It's a little like the chain of custody argument in legal evidence. Things don't necessarily follow in the order he gives from that one example off the coast of Africa. Yes, deoxygenated dead zones are forming in many parts of the world. But are they all simply caused by a lack of fish to eat algae? What about the pesticides and fertilizer runoff pumping the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico? Scientists think that the changing sea currents may have altered the upwelling of nutrients off the west coast, making that dead zone off of Oregon. Overfishing may be helping kill off the seas, but other factors like ocean acidification are part of the picture too. And keep in mind, the rich algae feed occurs only in certain parts of the ocean, generally off continents or seamounts, and in the cooler Arctic or Antarctic waters. The tropics have far less life to begin with, which is why those waters look so blue. Some are close to being deserts. So that chain of methane and hydrogen sulfide is not going to happen all over the world. And yet, the idea that hydrogen sulfide bubbling out of the ocean, causing mass extinction of land life, well, it's not as crackpot as you'd think. Here's a small clip from my own interview with Dr. Peter Ward, whose book Under a Green Sky proposes that as a lingering nemesis from ages past.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
And then it seems that the ocean somehow could become poisonous, if I understand the theory in your book right. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. One of the microbial groups that does best when there's no oxygen is a form that produces hydrogen sulfide. And hydrogen sulfide is a great poison. It's that rotten egg smell, and the reason that we react so strongly to it and hate it so much is that it is at very small concentrations, parts per million, can kill we humans. I mean, just the tiniest whiff of this stuff, we're so sensitive to it because we know intuitively or deep in ourselves that this is poison. We cannot deal with this stuff. Stay away, stay away. And yet when we have an ocean with no oxygen at its bottom, and worse, is no oxygen at its top, these microbes take over, and they can start producing, if they get enough nutrients, they can start producing enormous amounts of hydrogen sulfide. The hydrogen sulfide is a poison to all animals and plants. So it's not a good thing, and the microbes that produce this hydrogen sulfide have left behind little biomarkers, little bits and pieces of their cell walls in these Australian rocks we looked at. We've gotten the same stuff coming from your nice Canadian rocks of the same age. And in fact, we've now found these about 10 or 13 time intervals in the past, all coinciding with rapid global warming through volcanic events.
Peter Ward has spent a lifetime trying to find the causes of five or six previous mass extinctions, although I don't see a real profit opportunity in that. His book, Under a Green Sky, explaining how the seas could kill off planetary life from one climate shift that stops the ocean currents, it didn't sell well, he told me. Where's the product spin-offs, the business plan? No money to be made knowing what the Grim Reaper looks like, especially when it turns out to be just toxic bacteria anyway. No movie rights either. Aliens or zombies sell much more popcorn. Although Ward managed to sell that belching oceans idea into a cartoon version for Animal Planet in the spring of 2009. Let's move on to Doscher's claim that fish will be gone soon. His answer is to end commercial fishing all over the world. I presume he means by force, if necessary. I doubt even the U.S. Navy and Air Force could shoot down all those trawlers and those little fishing boats from who knows where, but maybe governments could hack up the docks or something. Over a billion people on Earth depend on fish as their major source of protein. Doscher says he once read a report from World Watch Institute saying all the fish will be dead by 2033. Sounds like a good date. I could be packed by then. But I wish I had the original report. There has been a better update on that prediction from a team of scientists representing some top ocean studies institutions. Their date for the end of commercial fishing, since there's nothing left, is 2048. Here's a quick slice from my Radio EcoShock report on dying fisheries from November 10th, 2006, still posted as a free download on my site, ecoshock.org.
The world is running out of seafood and running out soon. Exactly 42 years from now, in the year 2048, there will be nothing left to fish in oceans. That's the precise and dire conclusion of a major new study released today by the journal Science. Fish in the sea. Can we undo the damage before they're all gone?
Clam bakes, crab cakes, and even fish sticks could one day be a thing of the past.
Oh my God! The fish are dying!
A new report says if current trends of overfishing and pollution continue, all seafood could be wiped out in 40 years, and not just ocean life. Ecologists are also worried about fish in lakes and rivers. Experts say it's not too late to turn things around. They're calling for new marine reserves, better management to prevent overfishing, and tighter controls on pollution.
That's what kills me about mass media news. Horrors never before known can be reported in those news voices, followed immediately by the trivial, as though the disappearance of fish in the sea is just another story. Personally, I thought this woman's reaction was a little more realistic.
Oh my God! I can't believe it! I had no idea!
A homophobic preacher admits hiring a gay prostitute? Now that is interesting. Everyone is clicking to find out more. The end of seafood? Not so much. These days, notice I did not say in these end times, environmental news requires a horror soundtrack with cues for when we should cry out or scream. I suppose that's part of the mission of Radio EcoShock. In the May 2003 issue of the journal Nature, two scientists from Canada's Maritime Provinces released their study, Rapid Worldwide Depletion of Predatory Fish Communities. Their research showed that 90% of all large fish, the upper tier of predators, were already gone. Fish like tuna, marlin, swordfish, sharks, cod, and halibut. And they found it only takes 10 to 15 years for industrialized fishing to grind down any new stock to 10% of the original population. The few big fish that are left are noticeably smaller, one-fifth to one-half the size caught by a previous generation. The authors also called for a global effort to reduce the impacts of fishing, including fewer fishing boats, reduced bycatch, an end to government subsidies where they pay for all these boats, and for the most threatened species, cutting the catch in half. All right, in late October 2006, Dr. Worm was again the lead author in a major study by 14 scientists from Canada, the United Kingdom, the United States, Panama, and Australia. Institutions like Stanford University, the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, and Stockholm University were participating. It is titled Impact of Biodiversity Loss on Ocean Ecosystem Services and published in the journal Science for November 3rd. The team analyzed mountains of data about fish catches from around the world going back 50 years and even cross-checked against historical records up to 1,000 years old. Dr. Worm couldn't believe the computer analysis, and so cross-checked the results by hand.
And I saw that the trend of collapse of seafood species projected into the future predicts that by the year 2050 there will be no more species left to fish. And I really recall the hair standing up in the back of my neck and a shiver down my spine as I watched over the students, and I thought, it's going to be in all of your lifetime, and in my lifetime too. I'm going to be old, but still I will see this happen if nothing changes, if we don't change the way we're treating ocean ecosystems.
I get into it a lot more detail in that program, so go ahead and download it when you're ready. Maybe John Doscher isn't that far off after all. Toss in the Arctic Sea, summer ice melt, and a whole bunch of non-linear or positive feedback events. Maybe the fish will be gone by 2033. Here's Doscher's solution.
So here we go. 1. Close all marine fisheries. Restock them with fish using special ships that can transport them alive. Net excess plankton. Use them to generate methane to be immediately burned in combined cycle cogenerative power plants, which can be up to 94% efficient. And reduce carbon emissions tremendously for an interim period until that problem of the fisheries is solved and until a shift has been made to solar and wind.
Remember Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Society? He's been calling on the world's navies to start enforcing fisheries laws, as well as protecting the last of the major big species like whales, dolphins, and sharks. Too bad nobody does it. Right now there's a Japanese trawling fleet, or a Russian one, or somebody from Europe wiping out another Polynesian island's food supply for a generation, or trawling a seamount to death. It's happening right now, and there's nobody doing a damn thing about it. Maybe the fish will survive if we go extinct first. John Doscher suggests that could come as early as 2033. There's a nice ring to that. Should we have some kind of televised memorial planned, like Michael Jackson's? With a million-year retrospective on the big-brained apes. Or maybe just a huge celebration. Peace at last, let's party. Something bigger than the Olympics anyway as we go out. It sounds like crazy talk again, except the chief scientific advisor to the British government has just picked 2030 as a year of super crisis for the human race. Professor Sir John Beddington is the chief scientific advisor to Her Majesty's government, otherwise known as Britain. On March 19th, at an event called SDUK09, Beddington mused how converging crises, will at least cripple humanity, if not kill us off, by 2030. He begins with the fact we're stacking 6 million more humans a month on this planet to hit 8 billion people by 2030. Meanwhile, as Beddington tells the BBC...
First of all, there's an increase in the demand for food. That's going to be up by about 50% by 2030. The increase in the demand for energy is going to be up by a similar amount. And the demand for fresh water, which is really very important, is going to be up by something like 30 or 40%. At the same time, there are real problems that we can't just ignore the issue of climate change. So increasing the supply of food, energy and water has got to be done at the same time without presenting problems for mitigating greenhouse gas emissions to address the climate change problem. And all that's happening in 21 years.
Beddington predicts collapsing governments, food riots, mass starvation, and unimaginable numbers of climate refugees swarming for cover. Of course, being a government man, he doesn't think that's the end. He's ruthlessly optimistic. We'll find a way to grow twice as much food with half the water as crops die in the heat. Like a Hollywood movie, we human heroes always win in the end. Not according to Royal Academy scientist James Lovelock. He's recently suggested no more than 8% of our current billions will survive past the year 2100. Climate disruption should provide the diseases, droughts, and floods to do in the rest. So there you go. The experts agree, and maybe John Dosher's right there. We're all going to die. We just don't know when. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Tune in at our website, ecoshock.org, and check out our list of stations broadcasting the show. It's got to be some of the most depressing stuff on radio, but we strive for the truth.
Our duty to the human race is clear.
Our music is two versions of We're All Going to Die, one by Johnny Kula and the A-Grades, and then the same title by Malcolm Middleton, his cheery Christmas tune. You'll get that at the end.
Now what do we do?
Well, we'll probably continue to mutate. Then our very molecules will more than likely begin to break up. I'm sure our atoms will disperse slowly throughout the universe. I guess it's hopeless.
My thanks to Ren and Stimpy for saving us all. Let's get a pool going. Send me your preferred date for human extinction and a link to the website or news article giving the gory details. Maybe we'll make a whole show out of that. Send your entry to radio@ecoshock.org. You could win $2 billion, or last night with the partner of your choice, payable on our last day on Earth.
We're all gonna die, and what if there's nothing? We'll all have to face this alone. There's a wind on it, inside everybody.
Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Thanks so much for that, Alex. So now, on to the next installment of The Ascent of Humanity, the age of separation, the age of reunion, and the convergence of crises that's birthing the transition, by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. As we continue in Chapter 7 that's titled The Age of Reunion, the age of water. In a future where all costs are fully internalized and in which no object is created mindless of its origins and consequences, it would seem that technology itself would be nearly impossible. Many thinkers, recognizing the long-term unsustainability of industry even at 12th century levels, and perhaps even of agricultural civilization, can offer no alternative but a long descent back to the Stone Age, an erasure of a series of blunders that have brought us to our present condition. Admittedly, Stone Age life seems pretty fine to me, but as I have hinted throughout this book, I believe the heirs of our mad, senseless age are nonetheless setting the stage for a new phase of human development that brings the past into the future rather than trying to bring the future back to the past. Machine-age technology is fundamentally unsustainable, yes. But let us not assume that all possible technology shares this trait. In this section, I will outline a new mode of technology already emerging that is an extension and not a violation of nature. In Chapter 2, I wrote, quote, The unsustainability of our present system derives at bottom from its linearity, its assumption of an infinite reservoir of inputs and limitless capacity for waste. A fitting metaphor for such a system is fire, which involves a one-way conversion of matter from one form to another, liberating energy, light, and heat in the process. Just as our economy is burning through all forms of stored cultural and natural wealth to liberate energy in the form of money, so also does our industry burn up stored fossil fuels to liberate the energy that powers our technology. Both generate heat for a while, but also increasing amounts of cold, dead, toxic ash, gunk, and pollution. And whether the ash heap of wasted human lives or the strip mine pits and toxic waste dumps of industry. Fire is natural. In fact, it takes biological form in any aerobic being as the liberation of stored energy through oxidation. Nature only lasts because there are other steps, powered by sunlight, by which the ash is reincorporated into forms of stored energy. An economy that is sustainable must do the same. It cannot be based on fire alone, either in its literal or metaphoric form. The restorative economy, then, will have a technological infrastructure that is not based on the technologies of fire. From the Mayan perspective, we could view fire as a borrowing or a stealing from Gaia. When we burn wood, we replace the slow oxidative process that would ordinarily sustain generations of insects and fungi with the rapid oxidation of fire, therefore reducing life's possibility. According to Martin Prechtel's logic, any fire making, even the smallest campfire, should therefore be accompanied by some kind of ritual payment proportional to the quantity of fuel burned. A society that is truly sustainable would only use the technologies of fire with great circumspection. The technology described in the previous section is not so different from what we have today, for it still seeks to impose human control onto nature. A bike path, for instance, requires keeping the strip of earth away from its natural state. As the Maya realized, any technology by which nature is put under control and bent to human purposes entails a price. The primitive cultures recognized and paid, and that we have attempted to evade. Even if no actual fire, no preemption of oxidative energy stored in biomass is used, any technology that embodies fire's consumptive linearity and its co-optation of natural processes still runs on the fire model. Since almost all of our present technology derives somehow from fire, or seeks, like a bike path, to subdue nature, many ecologically oriented futurists quite naturally assume that a sustainable future means a low-tech future. This conclusion falls apart if we can envision a mode of technology not based on fire. I envision a high-tech future, but one whose technology is so dramatically different from our own that it is almost unrecognizable as technology to our present ways of thinking. The end of the age of fire promises a reversal of the course of separation and domination that fire has fueled. Immersed as we are in the ideology of separation, it's hard to conceive of a mode of technology that does not involve the objectification, domination, and control of nature. Yet such technologies exist, even if we hardly recognize them as such. They are not based on fire, but on earth, water, light, sound, and the human body. Rooted in an ancient past, they nonetheless carry the promise of a, quote, new age. Who knows what unconscious wisdom has named it the Age of Aquarius? But I shall call it the Age of Water. Water, to risk stating the obvious, carries metaphorical connotations very different from those of fire. Water denies linearity, cycling endlessly. It is also the agent of nature's cycles, nourishing both growth and decay. Similarly, it resists separation. Named the universal solvent, it tends away from purity to partake of its environment. Water is also the nemesis of control. Seeking out the tiniest crack, nothing can hold it in. As waves in the ocean, it destroys any bulwark. whereas fire burns clean and purifies what it touches, water makes a mess. Hence, the key to preserving anything, houses, books, food, clothes, metal, is to keep it dry. Water, with its cycles and flows, its unruliness, and its ubiquity on earth, could be called the essence of nature. To keep everything dry, and therefore outside the cycle of decay, transformation, and renewal, is a concrete expression of our separation from nature. It is this cleavage between human and nature to which the Age of Reunion will put an end. Earlier, I asked, since human beings are themselves natural, then isn't everything we make and do natural, too? To be natural isn't a matter of who designed something or what materials it's made from. The products of the human hand are only unnatural to the extent that they pretend to a linearity that defies the cyclical laws of nature. The industrial ecology described above is natural in that there is no waste. So I'm saying more than technology will be in harmony with nature, technology will be natural. We need not abandon our uniquely human gifts and return to the Stone Age or before. Instead, we will recover a Stone Age mentality in the context of modern technology. Underlying the future technological economy will be the principles of interdependence, cyclicity, abundance, and the gift mentality. Can you think of a better simile for all these four principles in that they are like water? Water upon which all depends. Water which moves in cycles. Water abundant to ubiquity. Water bringing the gift of life. Our dependence on water, the fact that we are made mostly of water, denies the primary conceit of civilization, that we are separate from nature or even nature's master. No more nature's master are we than we are the master of water. Yet for centuries we've tried to persuade ourselves otherwise. In science, our pretense of mastery manifests most fundamentally in the supposition that water is a structureless jumble of identical molecules, a generic medium, any two drops the same. To a standard substance, we can apply universal equations. That each part of the universe is unique is profoundly troubling to any science based on the general application of a standard technique. The same is true of technology. Only a universe constructed of generic building blocks is amenable to control. Just as the architectural engineer assumes that two steel beams of identical composition will have identical properties, so does the chemist believe the same of two samples of pure H2O. That any two samples of H2O, or graphite, or ethanol, or any pure chemical are identical is a dogma with enormous ramifications. It implies that the complexity and uniqueness of objects of our senses is an illusion, that they are mere permutations of some standard building blocks. Such a view naturally corresponds to the objectification of the world, which makes of it a collection of things, masses. The opposite view sees every piece of the universe as unique. No two drops of water, no two rocks, no two electrons are identical, but each has a unique individuality. This is essentially the view of animism, which assigns to each animate and inanimate object a spirit. To a Stone Age person, the idea that water from any source had a unique character or spirit would have seemed obvious. Modern chemistry denies it and says any apparent differences are merely due to impurities. The underlying water is the same. Animism says no. To have a spirit is to be unique, irreducibly and intrinsically unique. To have a spirit is to be special. With the dawning of the Age of Water, we return to our animistic roots and recognize the unique and spirited nature of each drop of water and indeed every substance in the universe. Not even the field of chemistry is immune to this paradigm shift, as it becomes increasingly apparent that water does indeed exhibit structure on several levels. Chemists and material scientists are now recognizing that structure maintained by hydrogen bonds and van der Waals forces is responsible for many of water's anomalous properties. Few, however, believe that this structure can convey information to biological systems. Yes, water has structure, they might admit, but there is no signal in the noise. Now let's leave the mainstream behind and take a journey away from scientific respectability. Our first stopping place is the empirical science of homeopathy, which has been developed over two centuries to a remarkable degree of sophistication, despite the absence of any cogent reductionistic theoretical underpinnings. In other words, no one really knows how it works. What is clear, however, is that it somehow uses water to convey the information embodied in natural substances to the body. Two different homeopathic samples of high potency may both be chemically pure H2O, but they are far from identical in their effects, a contention that has drawn considerable derision from critics. Perhaps because it is based upon water, homeopathy fosters a philosophy of healing very different from the conquest of nature that characterizes fire-based allopathy. Allopathic medicine is based on control, killing microbes, dictating hormone levels, cutting out organs and tumors. Whereas allopathic medicine dominates nature, homeopathic medicine sees nature as the body's teacher. The homeopath seeks out the natural substance that can teach the body a healthier pattern of being. Looking within nature instead of seeking to defeat or transcend it, the homeopath approaches healing in the spirit of water instead of fire. A bit further outside the mainstream is flower essence therapy, which, having been developed primarily through intuitive rather than empirical means, I prefer to call an art rather than a science. As in homeopathy, water serves as a character for information originating in flowers or other natural objects, used primarily for emotional or spiritual healing. Here again, each drop of water is unique. Here again, even more explicitly than in homeopathy, each drop of water is understood to possess a unique spirit. Masaru Emoto, a Japanese businessman, takes these ideas to their logical extreme. Emoto photographed ice crystals of water that he'd subjected to various influences, electromagnetic, emotional, musical, and so forth. The crystals exhibited striking differences. Even when he simply taped different messages onto jars containing samples of distilled water from the same source. For example, the samples shown words like devil, you fool, and so on, froze into ugly amorphous ice, while those shown words like love, gratitude, and cosmos formed into beautiful crystals. Despite an extensive search, I have found no serious refutation of Emoto's findings. Critics typically point to his failure to implement double-blind controls and his online PhD, but apparently the substance of his work is beneath them to even address. True, his work is not rigorous, but it isn't meant to be. It is beautiful, and to those to whom it rings true, suggestive of further directions in research. Essentially, Emoto's work confirms the metaphorical associations of water as a universal medium, a universal solvent, not only for physical materials, but for thoughts, feelings, energy, and information. Water carries the imprint of its environment, and since each lake, river, glass, or drop of water is uniquely located on Earth, each is subject to a unique combination of influences. At the same time, since this environment extends to include the whole planet and beyond, each drop of water contains the informational imprint of the whole. Emoto's work suggests that our every thought and intention affects every drop of water on Earth. It's just that the intended target of that intention, along with the water within our own bodies, is most strongly affected. A primitive hunter-gatherer would not find it difficult to believe that all water had a unique personality. That river water, lake water, rainwater, spring water, and water taken from the ground would have differing effects on the body and emotions, and perhaps distinct ceremonial uses as well. I imagine some languages don't even use the same word for these different types of water. Similarly, a hunter-gatherer would find it easy to believe that beloved water would have different properties from despised water. That we all believe water to be a uniform, lifeless substance that can be made identical by removing its impurities is a reflection of our ideology of objectivity and mechanism. We once knew better, before we made the world a thing, before we reduced the infinity of reality to a finitude of generic labels like water. A future technology of water will recover this knowledge, and we will no longer treat water as anything less than sacred. Emoto's work suggests that we cannot escape the effects of our thoughts, words, and actions. Released into the universe, they leave their imprint there, in effect reconfiguring the reality in which we live. In an age of water, we will understand this principle. We will understand that, like water, all things eventually cycle back to their source. An age of water will imitate the water cycle in its economics as well. Fire is the epitome of consumption, and it has incinerated social and natural capital for millennia. Today we are seeing the precursors to the cyclical economy of the age of water. All of the features of the restorative economy I have described, resource recycling, zero waste manufacturing, full cost accounting, and non-interest currency systems, equally justify the appellation water economy. Like demurrage currency, like the energy of the gift, water resists confinement, moves from high place to low, and ultimately circles back to its source. Perhaps the most profound transformation of the age of water will be our spirituality, how we relate ourselves to the universe. Above, when speaking of animism, I said that each water droplet or other object has a unique spirit, but that is not quite correct. The conception of spirit as something to be had, and therefore extrinsic to matter, is a metaphor of separation and a fire. What animism actually implies is that each thing is a unique spirit, that matter itself is spiritual, sacred, and special. Spirit can no more be abstracted out from matter than structure can be removed from the water that carries it. The age of water, then, is an age in which we treat the earth and everything in it as sacred. At the same time, water teaches us that the unique spirit of any bit of matter is not discrete and separate from the rest of reality. Like all things, including ourselves, water takes on the spiritual qualities of everything that surrounds it. Thanks to its ubiquity and receptivity, is also the medium of this communion of all with all. Unique we are, each one of us, yet no more separate than two drops of water in the ocean. The age of separation comes to an end with the dawning of the age of water. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Technologies of reunion. Cyclicity, abundance, connection. The money system and economy that embodies these qualities of water will give rise to a new mode of technology as well, one that is no longer an agent of separation. Because we have so long associated technologies with the qualities of fire, separating, purifying, and consuming, some of the new technologies that will define the age of reunion, we might hesitate to even call by that name. Others will seem mundane or even archaic to us today. There will be a revival of technologies thousands of years old, mixed with new inventions so unexpected as to seem miraculous. A common theme will unify this melange of low and high technology, all will rise from and contribute to the economics, science, and mentality of reunion that I have described. Who knows what heights green design and organic agriculture could reach with a full backing of a different currency and a different conception of the human role? What will happen when the trillions of dollars and millions of scientific careers currently devoted toward armaments turn to other purposes? Who knows, when there is an overriding business incentive to do so, how many industrial products and processes will be replaced by ecological alternatives? Who knows what the marriage of tradition and technology will bring to bicycles, to gardening, to sailing ships, hand tools, edible landscaping, fiber production, and farming? Aspects of the restorative economy are already appearing today in fits and starts. Wind is the fastest growing source of electricity. Here and there, buildings are going up that are net energy exporters. BMW is building cars that can be disassembled and the parts reused. Matsushita makes washing machines that can be completely disassembled with a single screwdriver. The trend is especially evident in agriculture, from Wes Jackson's permaculture to the movement of thousands of organic and small farmers away from the factory production model. Most of the technologies of the restorative economy exist already and have existed in some cases for decades. All that is missing is the cultural and economic context, the structural incentives to reward sustainable technologies, and the spiritual revolution that will end our dualistic alienation from nature. Concurrent with the resurgence of many low technologies will be the continued development of certain trends in high technology. For example, the storage, distribution, and manipulation of data will continue to demand less and less of a physical substrate. It will require less and less energy as well. Even nanotechnology, whose inflated promise I derided in Chapter 1, will produce new wonders. We will not, however, conceive of nanotechnology as a new level of domination over nature, but as a new area of intimate, co-creative partnership, motivated by beauty, not profit, or actually motivated by both, as the two will no longer be at odds. Again, I do not advocate the abdication of our human gifts of hand and mind, only the motivation, and therefore the direction and application of technology, will change. We can expect continued magic and miracles from technology as we know it. Some of the science fiction-y scenarios of future communications technology correspond remarkably to the shift in the human sense of self I have described. We can look at cell phones and instant messaging already as a form of telepathy. These technologies, after all, allow us to share our thoughts with other people over a distance. The dephysicalization of communication media could make such communication even more direct, to the point where we could indeed have access to large parts of each other's minds. Let's go through one of these scenarios, ignoring for now its truly Orwellian implications. Imagine that instead of a keyboard and mouse, implanted data input devices were already linked to neurons so that we could type or point and click at the speed of thought. Crude prototypes of such devices already exist. We could also upload to a computer archive any thought we wanted to remember or make available to other people. Meanwhile, we could receive messages with implanted devices that automatically stimulate auditory and optic neurons. Words, voices, and images would flash through our brains from an external source. But what is external? Wouldn't these collectively accessible data banks be an extension of our own brains, of our own selves? An extension shared with others, a common mind? How would the boundaries of self change when our private thoughts are no longer private, and the voices and images in our heads might come from somewhere else? When the linear technologies of certainty and control retreat to develop in their proper sphere, the way will be clear for other kinds of technology. What would a technology look like that was not rooted in the ontology of the discrete and separate self? Like the technologies of water, it would utilize connections that our present delusion of separateness renders invisible to us today. These connections are mediated not just by water, but by electromagnetic fields, by DNA, and by vibratory media presently unrecognized or unexplored by science. Yet they are foreshadowed in principle by 20th century science, by the observer dependency of quantum mechanics, and by the spontaneous organization of nonlinear systems, and by the cooperation and interconnectedness of all life on Earth. This mode of technology seeks human growth not by dominating an external environment, but by exploring and reifying the true vastness of what we actually are. The next stage of human development will come about because we stop resisting it and allow it to happen, not by engineering reality into some new and improved shape. This is a difference in motivation and conception, but not the end of science. The best of science will remain, the humility of the scientific method, the curiosity and wonder that drives it, and the awe and the mystery that sanctifies it. The goal will be different, though. In contrast to the ideology of assent described in Chapter 1, which seeks to control what is by knowing what is, future science will seek to know what should be. It, therefore, will require a knowledge of ourselves and our rightful place in nature. In this regard, it will draw from the new paradigms of biology described in Chapter 6, in which environmental purpose helps determine the evolution and behavior of the individual. It will draw as well from the primitive ritual sciences and shamanistic technologies, which sought a reconnection with the natural order and not its domination. For the natural order is far greater than we imagine it to be. I am not suggesting a retreat to some brute existence where we content ourselves with smelling the flowers and listening to the birds. Wait, let me take that back. There is far more to the scent of flowers and the songs of birds than we realize. What we label nature is an important key to unlocking human potential that few people today can imagine. The scents of flowers. Did you know that there is a sophisticated, highly nuanced technology that uses the vibrational essences of flowers as an agent for psycho-spiritual healing and personal development? Dismissed as New Age hooey, flower essence therapy, aromatherapy, and related modalities have tens of thousands of adherents in North America and England, whose primary texts exhibit an emotional sophistication and internal logical cogency that defy facile dismissal. They are part of a resurgence in herbal medicine that appeals to a connectedness between the human and plant worlds that goes beyond non-biochemical relationships. I especially recommend the books of Matthew Wood, Stephen Buhner, and Elliot Cowan for their placement of herbalism into a vaster, non-reductionistic paradigm. Conventional science, to the extent it recognizes the effectiveness of herbs at all, explains it reductionistically in terms of the direct linear effects of this or that active constituent. But as Wood, Buhner, and Cowan convincingly demonstrate, plants work as well through mechanisms that, for lack of better understanding, we can only call energetic, vibrational, or magical. And this lack of better understanding is the hallmark of a science in its mere infancy, hinting at a future science of magic, energy, or vibration that is to present efforts as a supercomputer is to an abacus. Another technology of reunion that produces astonishing results through a harmonizing with and not a domination of nature is biodynamic agriculture. Derided for some of its seemingly mystical elements, it is another infant technology that even its most ardent proponents are barely beginning to understand. Together with more mundane technologies such as permaculture and more mysterious technologies such as the intuitive garden techniques developed by Michaela Small-Wright, it holds the promise of a garden earth. I was about to call it a co-creative partnership between humans and nature, but the true potential is greater than that. It is the release of the divide between humans and nature, between the domestic and the wild. We can envision an agriculture that incorporates all the characteristics of an ecology rather than seeking to resist them. Besides water, biological chemicals such as DNA, enzymes, and pheromones are also media of interconnectedness. They act together to transmit information from one part of Gaia to another, from one part of any ecosystem to another, one part of an organism to another, so that each component can fulfill its function in the greater whole. If we human beings are to do the same, it stands to reason that future technology would fully develop the capabilities of each of these media. I am not talking here of genetic engineering, which attempts to subvert DNA to narrowly conceived human ambitions, the program of control on the molecular level. I refer rather to the untapped, even unsuspected genetic potential already present inside us and our symbiotic partners, all of life, including viruses. Sequestered amid our, quote, junk DNA lies dormant coding for capacities few can imagine today, awaiting the appropriate switches, stimuli from the somatic or external environment to become active. The biosphere is a treasure trove of genetic riches that we have barely begun to explore. It contains the means to achieve purposes undreamed of. Paul Stamets did not genetically engineer his mushrooms to detoxify toxic waste. Those capabilities already existed. He is merely a student and a steward of a marvelous nature. His work, and the work of horticulturists for thousands of years, suggests a different conception of technology, to receive the gifts of the earth and pass them on. That is the spirit of the gift, applied to science and technology. It is not a passive receiving, though. Careful observation, insight, and patient work are necessary to discover these gifts. The difference is a trust in the fundamental providence of nature that makes control-based technologies such as genetic engineering unnecessary. I just input DNA activation into my search engine, and I got 120,000 listings, a veritable cottage industry utterly outside the bounds of established science. Much of it is in the highly subjective realm of intuition, angelic channeling, and so forth, sometimes dressed up in flimsy pseudoscientific jargon. I find it more authentic when they don't pretend it is science. I was especially disappointed when I looked into Greg Braden's God Code and found one egregious abuse of mathematics after another in his proposition that our DNA encodes text from the Old Testament of the Bible. Disappointed is the word, not contemptuous, because on the level of poetry and myth, Braden is speaking some important truths. He is speaking to the innate sacredness and limitless potential of life. Underneath the New Age dross in this and related areas like biophotonics and bioenergy, there is valid insight and in some cases even sound scientific research. Pioneers always get something wrong. Keep in mind that these technologies are in their infancy. Not just DNA, but all of our biology harbors untapped potential that can be applied to healing creativity and the fuller participation in our cosmic purpose.